And you can change the distribution if you want. Now, do you want me to talk loud or?
No, that's fine. We're rolling and you can just go right ahead with whatever you want.
Okay.
Well, I'm interested in where you come from and what your parents did and where you, I think you're a very religious man. Is that right?
Well, I don't know. I don't. That's a problem of definition, and I wouldn't want to insist upon that. It depends. Some people would consider me the opposite, perhaps.
I should never have said, used a word like that to a historian. You'd be bound to say it was.
There are so many problems of definition when one tries to talk about religion. Some people think that you have to believe in a particular God to be religious, for example, and maybe you don't. I come from Upper East Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
My parents were farmers when I was born. Factory worker, later my father. I was born in the day before the stock market crash.
That's right, 1929.
1929, in fact, October 25th, the day before Black Thursday, I believe it was, on the stock market. My parents had come out after marriage to try to make it on a 50-acre farm in the mountains, a tobacco-growing area, when prices were good. They came to live in a little sharecropper's cabin, hoping that tobacco prices would help them build a new house. Well, they had one good year of farming, and then the tobacco prices plummeted in 30 and 31, and they could hardly pay off a little mortgage. So I grew up in extreme poverty.
Yes, I'd heard that. Meaning literally you were hungry at times?
No, I don't think we were hungry because we had a garden and grew food, but we didn't have any store-bought food for years. And it was not untypical. Many people suffered in the early Depression. I think people in rural areas were fortunate because they did have access to food. Mm-hmm. And it was a close-knit neighborhood, and people did take care of those who were in need.
Where had your parents come from?
That same area. They had been, my father had worked briefly on farms in Iowa and had gone to Detroit three different times to work in automobile factories when he was single. But he kept coming back to his home in that community. It was way off from any town. It doesn't even have a name out in the rural area.
And so your schooling was what?
A little part-time one-room school, part-time two-room school in a rural area, very typical of even parts of the Midwest then, in the 30s. And for 8 months, it was a reasonably good school, I thought. We had reasonably good teachers locally. And then went to a big high school, 90-some students. From the little elementary school.
Well, that doesn't explain anything about you yet.
Well,
are you a tremendously erudite person with a...
I was interested in books. I was starved for reading material when I got to high school because the elementary school had no real library.
But were your parents book people? Or?
We didn't have the money for books, but my mother loved to read, and insofar as we had the money, we had books, but not many, and we had newspapers, which even in the worst of the Depression, if I remember, we took a newspaper.
Well, what level of education were they?
My father only got through eighth grade, but my mother got through high school and had a little bit of college. I thought at one time of being a teacher, and even did fill in as a substitute teacher occasionally when I was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very interested in the intellectual pursuits in that sense.
When you were in high school, what did you expect to do with yourself afterwards?
Well, it was a problem. I didn't know. I took 4 years of agriculture in anticipation, perhaps, of being a farmer, but it was already increasingly unrealistic for people in that area to go into agriculture, and we knew it. But we didn't know what we wanted to do. I didn't want to work in a factory as my father then worked. And I was increasingly under pressure to go to college.
Under pressure from whom?
Most of my high school teachers. Mm. I was the valedictorian in high school and got a little bit of a scholarship from several local colleges. And they thought I should go to college, but I hadn't the slightest idea what I would be training for if I went to college. I was the only one, incidentally, out of my high school class to go to college in the years at the end of World War II.
Goodness.
And within 5 years, up to a third, probably, from the same high school, were going off to college.
Was there some particular teacher that you hadn't thought of history yet, though, had you?
Well, not as a field, no. Not even when I went to college. I was a chemistry major for a while.
Goodness, I didn't know that
for the
that
first
either.
three years. I it was in my junior year that I had to decide in between chemistry, English, or history. And I made the decision almost casually because I had to decide.
Mm-hmm. For history?
Yeah. I can't yet really remember any good reason for choosing one over the other.
Not a teacher?
I didn't like lab work. Mm. I love chemistry, theoretically, intellectually. But I didn't like bending test tubes and so on in a laboratory. Mm-hmm. It always seemed very boring. We were repeating work that had been done over and over again in lab manuals. It was not a large college, and they didn't have a good science facilities.
Where did you go to college?
It's a little local college, Milligan College, which was then non-accredited and very small, and almost went under in that period after the GI. GI started dropping out of college by 48 or 49. It was a hard period for small colleges everywhere, very much as today. Well, this college had a scandal with the president and lost its accreditation and dropped to nearly 200 students. But later it came back and made it. So I was in not a very good position to go to graduate school.
But you were thinking of it already.
No, not until probably my junior year. Then I did start seriously thinking about graduate school and recognized I was handicapped by the college.
So?
Well, I was able to go to Vanderbilt because they knew there one or two of the people who taught in history and knew the unusual circumstances of the college, and they would still take applicants from it. Mm-hmm. It's the only place I applied. And I had to have a fellowship, and I won both fellowship and admission and went. But it was not easy from that context. By then, I was very much persuaded that I would get an M.A. in history. I didn't really know much about a Ph.D. I thought an M.A. was the next goal.
So you weren't thinking yet of a career as a teacher?
No, I did my high school teaching certificate in college, and I had thought about perhaps teaching in high school level, and I thought an M.A. would be a valuable addition for doing that. Yeah. That's not untypical of people who end up in Ph.D. programs.
No, I realize that. But when did the you strike me as someone with an unusual passion for history and for acquiring knowledge generally? When did this start?
Well, I had a type of voracious appetite for all types of subjects. And history was only one that I was interested in. I still have great difficulty focusing or limiting my interest. I have a sneaking desire still to be a philosopher, for example, and a theologian, and I'm still interested in the hard sciences. I have had less interest in the social sciences, perhaps. When I think of the sciences, I still think of chemistry and physics, and I've kept up a lot of interest in what's going on in those fields.
Well, you justify that by saying that every historian should should know as much as possible about everything.
Well, you need to know in almost every field as much as you possibly can, and you at least have to be a knowledgeable consumer of knowledge or theories from almost all fields.
Well, you don't need to know a great deal from other fields to be a physicist, I wouldn't think, but I can certainly see it for an historian.
Yes, of course, historians specialize, too, and in their area of specialty, they often have to know a great deal. If you're writing the history of physics, you have to know a lot about physics. If you're trying in a more general sense to work with intellectual history, you have to know something about almost all the fields.
And literature.
And literature also. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you give yourself an excuse to read everything, then?
Well, as much as one can. I find I'm not reading as much, I think, as in the past. I was a voracious reader in the high school and college years. I used to come home and read a book every night until my parents would make me go to bed of a night. Now I find that so often my required reading, the books that I have to review or the books that are necessary in preparing a course, or the books that are related to my own scholarship, occupy almost all my time.
I find that's one
of the frustrating aspects of getting more and more involved in a profession.
Mm-hmm.
You do limit yourself in a sense.
So many people are writing things that you have to read. Everything they write.
Well, you constantly have a need to keep up in your own field. And there's so much that you can't really read it all. And you feel guilty. And if you're going to write a lot of books, you can't read all of them. You have to write books. So And increasingly you read those books that are directly related, as I'm doing this morning, to what I'm now writing on.
You know, this makes me think of a question I was going to bring in later, which is there some point where you have accumulated enough knowledge so that you can, whatever you decide to write about, you can more or less easily pick up, but you know where you have your ideas there and you just have to put them in order. I'm thinking in terms, comparing it to a well-stocked kitchen where whatever dish you decide to make, you've got everything there, whereas the beginner has to rush off to the grocery store periodically.
Well, I haven't. The way to do that is to pick a narrow specialty and do all your work in that field. As one historian once told me, who'd worked very narrowly in American economic history, by the time he got his first book done, he had half the research for the second and a fourth of the research for the third, if he stayed in the same field. Mm-hmm. And after a while, in all likelihood, most of the knowledge you need for doing a book would already be there. But I've moved around routinely, not only from topics within intellectual history, but between recent American history, political history, and intellectual history. I get bored with a subject after about one book, and I don't like to continue. So in many cases, I've virtually started over, mm-hmm. which is more fun to me. You learn a lot more that way.
You said the reason you wrote your last book, which was on economic historians before the Civil War.
No, the one I'm now completing is on American economists, political economists before the Civil War. Mm-hmm.
And you said you wrote it to fill in a gap in your knowledge in the course on intellectual history you're teaching.
It was an area where I did not feel I was well enough informed to give responsible lectures to upper-level students. And it's an area I wanted to know more about. And an area I did not know a great deal about when I started, so I had to do all the spade work. I couldn't coast on any past achievement there.
This made me feel that teaching has a more important place in your scheme of things than it does with some people. That is, that you would write a book in order to fill in a spot in your teaching.
Well, I think all of our work is in the form of teaching. We get some satisfaction out of knowing, the satisfaction of curiosity, but I don't think many scholars would be happy with just that type of achievement. They want to inform other people. And what we publish is directed at a different audience, but it's still a form of teaching. And I have tried to integrate classroom teaching with my own scholarship.
Say that again, would you?
Which?
I have tried.
I've tried to integrate my classroom teaching with my own scholarship and make the two complement each other. That way, my course preparation can be part of the process of creating a book, and the students can have an input. They challenge me and help me in my own thinking process. And in turn, I hope that the result of the scholarship improves the level and quality of the teaching and what the students receive. At the college level, at least, our highest responsibility is toward the content, what we give students, that we tell the truth about the past, for example, as historians. It's not a forensic display or a form of showmanship. That might be a nice addition to teaching, but it's not the central purpose. If we do not give students, in upper-level courses at least, the latest and best information possible, we deceive them. And they usually don't know when they're being deceived. So our responsibility is toward the product, that we really bring them into contact with someone involved in inquiry, the most rigorous type of inquiry in a field, and that we bring them the product of the most recent inquiry. At least I conceive of it that way.
Do you think most of your colleagues do?
I suppose so. I won't speak for all of them. The teaching field, at least at the level of administrators, involves other criterion, I think. We are concerned here at the University of Wisconsin with budget problems, and the type of support we get from the state is in part tied to enrollments, and thus there's always continuous pressure to up enrollments. And in declining areas, in the humanities, for example, whether we retain staff or are able to make important new appointments is in part related to our enrollment, the number of people who take our courses. I think this does create norms or expectations that have very little to do at times with the with scholarly integrity. It creates a compulsion to have popular courses. Even at times, perhaps, it creates pressures for lowering grade standards so we'll attract more students. And these non-scholarly criteria can play too much of a role, I think, in what we do. And we're all at times open to those concerns. I have tried to maintain the integrity of the content of my courses, even though it's often very demanding. And I've tried, even in the period of the 60s, to keep my grading standards very high. That at times meant that I was not necessarily the most popular teacher. And my courses are not high enrollment courses, except the surveys. Mm-hmm. It's a real problem of conscience, I think, generally among academicians. We face it only in a slight sense here at Wisconsin, but in small colleges where recruiting and keeping students is a matter of survival, faculty are under intense pressure not even to fail anyone.
Yeah.
And I can understand, I can sympathize with their with the dilemma they're under.
I wanted to ask you whether you remember any books that you were reading from the, say, high school or college that were that particularly influenced you.
No.
You don't? Okay.
There were none. I don't think there were any. I do remember a book that first oriented me toward intellectual history in college that I thought was a great book, and that's John Herman Randall, Jr.'s The Making of the Modern Mind, a vast synthesis of Western thought that I'd probably pick to pieces today on detail,
yes.
But at the time it was an inspiring book for a lot of us in college. And it, for the first time, gave me a little bit of an inkling of what intellectual history was, although I don't think I used the term then.
Tell me the anecdote that you told me about the boy in the fourth grade class.
When I went to Midvale Elementary School to following, I think, a hockey player the week before, but different people coming, sometimes parents, to talk about different occupations or vocations. And my daughter told the teacher she should invite me to talk about history, being an historian. And I tried to make a simple presentation and brought along some books about what a historian does. And then at the end, a bright kid, young boy, whose father probably is a physicist or something, was trying to relate history to the sciences and asked me, embarrassingly, what type of breakthrough I'd made in the field. And since I couldn't give a ready response to that one, I'm sure he concluded that I was not a very important historian at all. I hadn't made a single breakthrough. It was difficult to try to explain that in areas like history, we don't have the spectacular breakthroughs that typify the physical sciences.
You went on from that to say that the process by which you wrote, that's what I'm leading up to, that you go into the office every day.
Yeah, I find work discipline important, to have a place to go and hours to keep.
And that you write every day.
And try to write something practically every day, not necessarily part of a chapter of a book. I write a lot of my lectures, and I keep rewriting lectures, and often make them very formal and have them typed up as essays, and a few of them I've published as articles. So in one way or another, I think one who writes ought to write something every day, except on the weekend, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. But you really do stick to this?
Yes, I write continuously.
How many hours a day?
Oh, no set amount. Often it's a matter of lecture preparation, but I think it's good if you are a writer to, in your lecture preparation, to come to the final showdown and write it formally, write it down.
Why?
Because I find that I write more fluently if I do it all the time, and if I have a big vacation from writing, a year, for example, in which you do research, only research, and no writing, I find it exceedingly difficult to get back to the writing.
Do you know why?
I think it's almost any skill has to be continuously exercised to do well, whether it be playing table tennis or what else. And I think writing is a skill, and I think you have to keep at it. And if you take away from it for a long time, now a break of a couple of weeks may at times be be therapeutic and desirable. But if you're away from it for a long time, it's very hard to go back to it. That's why I think people who are in administration in colleges, 5, 10 years dean, have great difficulty getting back to scholarship and to writing. They've lost the skill, in part. They could regain it, but it takes a lot of extra work. That's why I deplore the often radical separation of what's called research from writing. People at the PhD dissertation level often spend a year and a half or 2 years collecting materials, really transferring them from distant libraries to their own note cards. And then they get around to writing what they conceive of as a report on their research, and I find often they have great difficulty doing so. I encourage them to write in the midst of their research, and in some cases, when they've got background information, if possible, write and then do the research. That's a bit facetious, but it's probably a better technique than what many of them follow. I had one PhD student who took a year then to sort out an enormous amount of notes he'd collected over 3 years. He took a year to get them sorted. And in my estimation, his research began at that point when he started writing, because at that point he began to ask questions of the material rather than just accumulate a mass of material. Asking questions of the material is what I conceive of as research.
Because the facts themselves are nothing until you've...
It's just accumulated artifacts pulled in from different depositories, perhaps partially organized and clustered in file cabinets.
Like pieces of pots.
Right. As Croce and other philosophers of history have said, these are dead artifacts from the past. They're not evidence for anything until they become actively involved in the answering of questions that historians bring to them. And I think that collecting process or transferring of records process often goes under the name of research, and I don't think it deserves it.
Yes, that's quite a different notion.
Well, I think it's very important that the active thinking through of a subject and the consulting of different sources go on simultaneously. And I'd urge students that in the midst of what they call research, they often have some happy ideas about how it all fits together. Stop taking notes on cards and write a section of a chapter at that point, because you'll probably never have the freshness and originality of thought that you had at that moment. Even though you have bits and pieces of your final manuscript and later have to put them together, nonetheless, do the actual constructive thinking in the midst of the research.
So there's something actually about writing things down, because you can have ideas in your head, but that isn't enough.
Well, you must have the ideas in your head. I think always anyone who is doing even an article in history will find that there are days when it's hard to say anything at all. And then maybe you'll wake up in the middle of the night and it all makes sense to you. And that's the time, as quickly as possible, at least the next morning, furiously write it down. Even though you may be inaccurate on one or two of the details, go ahead and write it all down and then come back later with your note cards and correct it in detail and put in the footnotes. But when you have those periods of enthusiasm, of creative enthusiasm, use them right then. Yeah. Don't wait. Don't even necessarily spend any time to get to your office. If you want to do it at home. Get it down. I've made little, what I call idea note cards, or pages with a certain line of thought outlined on it, and find out that that's more important than all the factual material I have when I later construct a chapter.
Well, I'm glad to hear this, because the other day I thought you said that you said you didn't have a flash of an idea when you were gardening, for instance.
No.
And that you counted on the process of writing to bring the ideas out.
Often so. Gardening is a type of vocation almost with me, and it takes my full attention, and it's not a time for reflecting on other things.
But this wouldn't be true of waking up in the middle of the night or sitting at dinner.
I don't sleep continuously ever. In fact, my deep sleep is probably no more than an hour and a half. And I'm in a semi-awake status the rest of the night always, on and off. I wake up maybe 100 times in a night, just momentarily. It's a kind of a very shallow type of sleep that I have. And if I'm writing, I often find it hard to sleep. And then after a brief period of deep sleep, I will literally spend hours in the early morning hours going through all of this. I get intensely involved at times when I'm in the midst of writing a book, and I don't sleep well. And I think that's good.
I was going to say, do you regard that as a pathological condition or as a treat or lucky?
I've never thought of insomnia as a problem. It may be an opportunity. I think people generally get all the sleep they need.
I have read that, in fact, we get much more than we need. So you don't try to relax your mind and read a mystery story or?
No. No, when I'm in, there are periods, and these are not often, and I don't think I could sustain them for a long, long time, but when I do get deeply involved, and I'm in an article, I'm trying to think through an article, there may be maybe a few days when I'm really bound up in that, even often not meeting someone in the hallway and not speaking to them because I'm so bound up I don't even see them, a type of absorption.
How does this affect your family?
Well, it's a little hard on them, I think, when I get that way, because then the little practical problems of a washing machine that breaks down, I resent it intruding, although I'll try to fix it.
But these are just, what, brief periods? A few days or a week?
I don't think it would be fair to colleagues or friends or family if one were so absorbed in task all the time. It'd be almost inhumane, I think. But I think these interludes are often necessary when you rather intensely concentrate on a subject. It comes to a point near of something close to self-hypnosis, and I think from all I've read recently, perhaps the best definition of what we used to call hypnosis is intense concentration, where you shut out more and more of the outside until the point you're hardly aware of outside stimuli at all. And if that's what hypnosis is, it's nothing new. And we often do it best for ourselves. We don't depend upon someone else to hypnotize us. I think students often in studying for an exam are literally amazed at what they can accomplish in an hour and a half when they have that type of intense concentration, or how rapidly they can absorb a whole book. They can scan a book, a 500-page book, in a couple of hours and know it very well if they're able to concentrate enough. It's tiring. 2 hours is about enough.
Did you have this from the beginning, or did you have to work at it?
No, I don't have it as well as in the past. I found that in graduate school, particularly the year I was doing a dissertation, I could go into a library for 8 hours, and there were no distractions at all. And I developed great powers of concentration, and I've never since then I've had, I think, the ability to concentrate the way I did then, after working for months. Then I could turn out a chapter often in 2 or 3 days if I got things going right. And it was amazing how much progress I could make then. But after you once assume your responsibilities as a teacher, it's rare that you have any long period of time without distractions. You've got a whole range of responsibilities, and you have to give due to all of them. So you can't do that. I think it's a luxury of graduate students often to have unbroken expanses of time that they can use entirely for their dissertation.
So when you get you've had a Guggenheim and various other research grants, you you can use this time, but you can't get back to that kind of concentration?
Not quite, because there's still graduate students and family responsibilities too. I have never written books except when I had time off from teaching. I've thought about them. I've used lecture preparation as a substitute for getting chapters partially developed. But to get down to completing a book, I've always done that in the summer when I'm off teaching or in the period I've had off sabbaticals. So most of my actual writing has been concentrated into relatively small periods of time when I'm not teaching.
Does writing come easier to you now than it did?
No, I don't think it comes easier. I have become much more self-conscious as a writer, perhaps in some ways not as fluent a writer, because I am so often questioning what I write as to precision and word use. I think I write more precisely than in the past, but probably at times not as eloquently. It's once you have this conceptual self-consciousness, you can't go back to the way it was before.
But the eloquence must come from a deep belief in what you're writing about, which you must still have. No, you're making a face.
No, I don't think. I don't think that's it. I think, again, that's an acquired skill in part. It's a verbal skill that probably goes back to childhood. I suspect that people who grow up in an intensely verbal atmosphere and environment where talking is valued and constant, where storytelling is one of the modes of entertainment, where they're constantly called upon or expected to perform in a verbal way, and they develop facility in doing that as a child, I think that probably along with such achievements as a very broad vocabulary, I find so many of our students don't have a broad vocabulary, and they frequently are not able to come to the word they really need to express
yours
themselves.
Yours is extraordinary. I had quite a struggle reading some of the things
you wrote.
Well,
that's a problem. I shouldn't do. I want to write in such a way, except in specialized fields.
Oh, it's not. It's perfectly clear, but it's your words are pithy, and one has to.
But I think one wants the correct word, but insofar as possible, always choose a simpler word.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like jargon if one can avoid it.
That was one thing you said that interested me. That history did not use a jargon. And
well, not the other discipline we're involved with. And I suppose I do a little of that in philosophy. If I'm writing about philosophers, there's a type of language that philosophers use with each other that's
like
rather
ontological.
Well, those are terms that one could substitute, but you'd have to substitute a whole series of phrases in order to communicate what you want by words like that. They become conventions and useful ones for philosophers, but they may not be familiar to a lay audience, and I think historians have to be careful. If they use technical terms, they ought to carefully define them at least somewhere so that laymen will be able to cope with them.
I wanted to bring in the phrase the genius for meditation, which you said was one of the five criterion or requirements of a good historian.
Well, that was actually my colleague Roland Stromberg who added that little section. You were reading from a jointly authored book, and that comes.
Oh, I thought that whole section was by you.
No, that section. I think that comes at the end.
It was the last little.
We joined in that, and
so
parts of that, fragments of that, came from each one of us. But that was his.
Oh,
don't ask me to explain exactly what he meant by it.
Let me just check and see if I. What is the most exciting part of what you do?
I don't think of it day by day as being exciting, I suppose. I suppose I still get the greatest thrill out of lecturing to students or to any audience. It's still frightening, and particularly frightening when you've been away even for a summer to go into a classroom. But by the very fact that it's frightening shows that you take it very seriously. It's very important. And I think all of us want to, when we're trying to communicate with other people, we want to be understood and we want to make an impression. And we want the people out there to respond. And so there, I suppose, you do get some of the aspects of entertainment or showmanship or people who have to appear in a public capacity before an audience. And it's still a thrill. I look forward to it, even as I have some degree of apprehension about doing it.
So that even more than writing what you feel is a...
Well, there are moments of unexpected satisfaction in writing when things do mesh or when you're able to complete something that's been giving you problems for weeks and it all comes out and you look back the next day and it reads reasonably well. That's thrilling in itself. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's ever that element that you have in appearing in a public capacity to lecture, that apprehension, that tension, and often, although it doesn't always work, a great sense of satisfaction when it's all over and it's gone, things have worked correctly. And you really feel good about it, although there can be a momentary letdown when it's all over then because the thrill's all over then. Now, I don't think you have those high points as frequently in writing, although they do come. And they're often unexpected, even as in writing occasionally, after laboriously trying to write for days and plodding along in a rather methodical sort of way, suddenly thoughts come to your mind and you get them down on paper that you'd never anticipated at all. There's this element, as John Dewey refers to it in all creative exercises, there's elements of unexpected spontaneity that come into it all. And they thrill you when they come. And they don't come, I think, until there's been a lot of laborious work. Mm-hmm. Unrewarding. The days when you can't get a whole page written and struggle with one paragraph. And the next day you come in and it flows and you write 10 pages before the day's over and it reads real well. Those don't happen too often, though.
What's the most difficult part of it, of your work?
Well, there's drudgery involved in teaching and in scholarship. There's the drudgery of research that's unsuccessful. You hope that you find something and you go through week after week of the congressional record and nothing that relates to your topic even shows up. Or you're going through masses of newspapers expecting that there's going to be relevant material and you find nothing at all. And that's unrewarding work, to say the least, often very frustrating work. And in teaching, there's a lot of the mechanics of teaching that are always going to be difficult. Some people don't enjoy preparing lectures. I don't think any of us, after a time, enjoy grading papers endlessly, particularly when so many of them are bad and you have to write endless critical evaluations. That becomes a form of drudgery. I think teaching is an exciting field. Mm-hmm. And I think writing's exciting. So I'm sure that the elements of sheer drudgery are probably less in my profession than in most. But it wouldn't be fair if we didn't have that as one side to it all. We have to pay too.
Well, of the books you've written, which is your favorite?
Well, Puritans and Pragmatists, it's a heavy book on American philosophy. I put more into it. I worked on it for over 8 years continuously. It's a big book not only in size, but because I tried in rather tight chapters to summarize the thought of very important philosophers, Dewey, Santayana, James, hoping to pack into 100 pages, because they are very large chapters, hoping to pack into 100 pages as much solid content as in a biography of each one of them. Mm-hmm. So it's a concentrated amount of material in one book, which is one of the problems with the book, because it's demanding on readers.
I read the first one on Jonathan Edwards.
Well, that's an easy chapter.
<Was it? laughs>
That's an easy chapter compared to some of the later ones, for example, on Charles Peirce. It's a tiring book for readers because they have to work awfully hard. It's a lot of compacted material in a short space. But I am still more pleased with that book than any other because I put more into it. I don't think I could ever do that much intellectual effort again for a single book. It'd be hard to ever do that much again.
Hmm. And the one on self-evident truths, which must be a fulfilling one of your requirements of history, that it apply criticism and knowledge to ideas that we tend to accept automatically, the American ideas.
Well, I don't think anyone should go to the trouble of writing anything about the past unless they think that it's going to be of some use to someone,
uh-huh.
That people are going to find something rewarding in the reading. I don't think anyone really does history except with the expectation that what they do is worthwhile. So we always write with the expectation of an audience that somehow either wants or will gain something from reading what we do. Self-evident truths may appear as a centennial piece, but actually I completed it in 73 and published it in 74. And I hadn't thought when I began it, I had not thought of it as a book for the bicentennial, although it was so publicized by the publisher for good reason, of course. That is a long synthesis of certain political concepts that came to fruition in the Revolutionary period, in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. So in that sense, it was an exploration of our institutional roots of deliberately trying to inform Americans in a much more rigorous way than they usually approach these issues of what content went into our institutions, what basic assumptions, beliefs, preferences. And in that sense, it was broad-based series of essays sweeping over a whole lot of history very quickly. but essentially one prolonged essay.
Mm-hmm.
And a smaller book than Puritans and Pragmatists, and a quite different sort of book.
The one that appealed to me, The Challenge of History, which you said you co-authored with somebody else, but this the section on...
The second section on the philosophy of history was all mine.
Yes.
And Roland Stromberg did the history of history, but we cooperated on an intermediate or transitional chapter, and we cooperated on the final essay at the end. So.
But it was your chapter on the use of history that particularly interested me, because I wondered why you wrote the book. You were quite young when you did. I mean, you were 42.
And thought about how old I was. It didn't seem too young.
Didn't it? Struck me as the sort of thing you'd usually wait till you were 60 to write.
Yeah, I don't know why. When I first came to Wisconsin, I was increasingly interested in philosophy of history as a whole, some of the philosophical issues related to history. And for the life of me, I don't know why I decided to do that. And then Roland Stromberg and I got together because he was working in the history of history, and we got together. Originally, I'd planned that as a small book, and it was a happy idea of the two of us when talking together that we combine them. But I don't know why. It was the second year I was at Wisconsin. I spent one whole summer that I had on leave, and then part of the year following, working out these chapters.
Well, you must have had some compelling need to put
I think at that point I was trying to clarify my own role as a historian and to think through problems that related to me as a historian, rather than sitting down and deciding I'm going to write this book for the edification of other historians. I think in part it was in that one case an attempt to think through some issues for myself. And it springed from that. I can't even remember when I finally decided to put together in the form of a book.
I thought maybe you'd written it because at one point you spoke of people recently saying that history had proved that there was no progress. And I thought you were thinking perhaps of the protest movement in the 60s and that the use of history as... saying that man hadn't gotten anywhere, and you wanted to show that wasn't the way to use history.
Well, it did come in the midst of all the protest on campus. I'd be hard put to suggest how directly they influenced either the choice of topics or how I treated them. Maybe they did. I think in the chapter on use, certainly there's some references to the Vietnam War as a form of tragic experience.
Yes.
Certainly current events had something to do with the illustrations that I used in there. I thought that would be a way of making people understand what I was driving at.
You said that history should provide aesthetic pleasure to the historian and to the reader. That was a sort of personal gain from it.
Sure. Every type of inquiry should do that. I feel sorry for a scientist who spends 30 years working on some problem and never getting any personal satisfaction and sense of artistic achievement from doing it. That is, if he has a sense of punching the clock 8 to 5 every day and no other satisfaction except getting paid at the end of the month for doing it, I'm not sure he'll be the best scientist or keep up the effort needed to carry it through to completion. I think aesthetic returns are part of any creative activity, or should be, and we shouldn't dismiss them lightly. After all, I can think of no valid reason for pursuing any type of activity except that somewhere along the line it eventuated in good experience for someone. Can you? So
no.
What is good in the having should not be discounted. And instrumental types of good, those things that lead to something else, and ultimately to something that's good, should not be necessarily elevated above those that are in themselves pleasing and satisfying.
Hmm.
Don't knock the pleasure of the moment, in other words. Because ultimately, what is there to motivate any of our effort except some type of fulfilling experience?
This isn't the usual notion, is it?
Well, what alternative can you suggest? Now, this gets into rather thorny issues in ethical theory, but in some sense of the word, I suppose almost any ethical commitment is utilitarian. That is, it looks towards some type of happiness for someone. The someone may be in the distant future, or it may be a divine creature off somewhere else, and you're doing it for the glory of God, but at least you're, even then, responding to his concerns. If effort does not relate to any concern of any sensible creature, why do it? So if reading a book of history is in itself enjoyable, that may be almost enough to justify it, although I think that invariably, in the process of enjoying it, you're slightly revising some of your beliefs and preferences. You're going to be a different person as a result.
And the people around you, therefore, will become different.
Right.
Yes.
And it will have broader social impact than just pleasing you. But if it doesn't, if it's not enjoyable, you probably won't go to the trouble to get all these other benefits anyway. You won't read it. So grace and eloquence and form are indispensable, I think, for historians. They're not writing research reports. They're writing stories that they want people to read. And if no one reads them, they've gained nothing from the effort.
You seem to think that two of the most valuable things that you gained from history were self-esteem and self-knowledge.
Well, self-knowledge and self-esteem are probably related. We, from understanding our past, do gain an understanding of who we are, of many of the things we do habitually without thinking about them. We come to some comprehension of why we do them. It may not lead to self-esteem or self-congratulations because we may, by burying why we do them, we may find that we have no valid reasons for doing them at all, or we may react in moral horror at times to what we've been doing all along without thinking about it. So esteem is one thing, knowledge is the other. If we find that we can, through understanding, now come to a fuller appreciation of some of the things we do, some of the institutions we share, that is, common ways of carrying out our government even, we're happy. It's great if we're able to appreciatively understand and endorse what we've been doing all along. Then we have a sense of participation, of roots, of being part of our society that we perhaps did not have before. But it's at least always as likely that better understanding will lead to a much more critical stance toward what we're doing and a desire to change the way we do things. And in that sense, it doesn't lead to any type of exhilaration, but often sheer moral horror. It's not always delightful to know ourselves. We sometimes don't like what we find.
Now, this is political man you're talking about.
Well, moral. Politics, after all, is only a branch of morality, the branch of morality dealing with social issues, collective behavior. Mm-hmm. To be political is to be moral, and to be moral is to be political. That is, in some sense, concerned with broader issues of human relationships. And politics is a means or mode of realizing some of them. I suppose I assume that everyone is political.
Hmm.
That is, I assume that everyone is, in some area or another, morally sensitive, concerned. And I suppose that it's a type of cultural pathology if we create a lot of people who are not morally concerned, which is to say, not political.
Oh, you assume that by nature people are...
No, I don't assume that by nature. I'm not sure that there's such a thing as human nature. In fact, I have a profound doubt that there is any constant meaning one can give to the idea of human nature. I do think that as one is nurtured in a social setting, and a child cannot survive without help and care for other people, thus we're incurably social to that extent, then in the nurturing of a person, that he will normally develop as he goes along sensitivity to other people's feelings, because he is so dependent upon his mutual interaction with other people that sympathy or empathy for others is a natural part of the maturing process. I'm not sure it's rooted in nature. I'm a little hard put to define that, but I think it's very rare that you find people who are not sensitive to other people's needs and concerns. And to move beyond that awareness and concern or sensitivity to actually trying to improve or do something about them is to be political. Now, I know that there are other uses of the word political, some of which are so pejorative that politics stands almost opposed to moral concern. That is, politics means cynical manipulation of other people, for example, for your own purposes. I don't like that use of the word, but I cannot dictate how people use words. I can only clarify how I use them. The one area where we're all in a sense, absolute dictators, is an area of semantics. We can, if we want, at some peril of misunderstanding, use a word the way we want, and no one can say nay.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, it's a considerable peril.
Yes.
Is there something, a subject that we haven't covered that you would like to cover or that you think of?
Well, there are a lot of subjects.
I wondered, you said in that chapter, what we appreciate, what we love, what we dedicate ourselves to is what we are.
Right, the problem of identity.
Mm. What, in your case? What would those things be?
Oh, that's an impossible question.
Is it?
That's to explore all too quickly one's deepest moral convictions, even ultimately one's conception of reality and of man's place in the universe and all of that. I think it's a legitimate question, but I don't think it's one that lends itself to any quick answer or ready answer. I always feel frustrated, even when my children come through with questions of that sort, and I feel cowardly because I always beg off. It's probably better not to give a brief answer, mm-hmm. because it can only confuse or oversimplify. Yet to refuse to answer at all is a bit cowardly, or seems so to them. But are they ready, and really more important, are they willing to carry on a dialogue that might go on for weeks and months? Maybe on occasion they are, but it's very rare. Now, bits and pieces of what we are most deeply committed to comes through in our exchange with other people, invariably, but it's often difficult for other people to decipher what those ultimate commitments might be. I have that problem with students. In intellectual history, you're working with religious thought, with philosophical thought, and getting often very close to the most deeply held views of students in ways that challenge them. And they rightfully ask me often, well, how do you feel about an issue? Do you believe in God? And it doesn't help when I say which God, but unless there's a good bit of clarification, I'm not sure I can honestly answer the question. And if I tried to do that in the class, I would probably, in serving the interest or concerns of one student, ignore the commitment I have to all the others to go on with the course. So periodically, when they ask those types of personal questions, which require a lot of time, I say, good, I'll be glad to talk about that. Come in this afternoon. We'll spend the whole afternoon, if you want, pursuing that question, but in the office, not here, because we don't have the time or space. I feel a little bit about that question here.
Do they come?
A few, yes, and most of all in areas of religious concern. And usually those who are deeply committed to one religious tradition or another and are concerned, even at times concerned for my salvation.
Hmm.
And I've had a few students from evangelical sects that have really wanted to convert me even. And I admire them for wanting to convert me. They have something that they think is very wonderful and they want to share it with me, and they're very concerned if I don't share it. And I appreciate the concern, although I rarely respond in the way they want to their effort.
I guess I felt that you bring history more into your life than most people that I have talked to, and that when you say you appreciate and love history, which you would say, that it would be saying much more than.
Well, I suppose historians, by their profession alone, are more continuously confronted with issues about the past. They're continuously trying to understand the present in light of a past, or often contrastingly by other people's past. We're continuously rethinking our past, and I suppose the identity of a historian is a bit more vulnerable than most people are, should be. That is, we're continuously reformulating our conception of who we are. This opens up possibilities, I think, of immense growth, of continuous change. Historians perhaps do change more through their life than other people. But there are insecurities that go along with this, as you know. You you don't rest content with being someone today and the same person a year hence. You always have a sense of, all people, I suppose, have a sense of change, but perhaps historians have a sense of their own personal pilgrimage that's a little bit more clear to them than a lot of people.
That's true. Do you explain to your students why you think they should study history, or do you merely teach history?
No, it varies. I sometimes give both an introductory lecture and a concluding lecture with much of the same content as that essay on the uses of history, and very elaborately explain what I'm about in the course and the objectives of the course and what I expect them to get out of the course and why I'm doing it and so on. In other cases, I don't. I let the course itself, the content, speak, I hope, even though indirectly, to what it's all about. And it's a matter of strategy. I change almost every other year on this. I've got several opening lectures for my courses packed away in a file cabinet now. At times, I have felt very, very much concerned, in fact, a responsibility to make very clear to students on the first day everything it's, we're about and what my purposes are, as a matter of honesty. In other cases, I've decided I'd only confuse them. Just start with the content.
I wonder which works best.
I don't know. I don't know.
I guess we'd better stop.